This is Night Call, the first and only nationwide listener call-in show on vital issues. Tonight's subject, the philosophy of Ayn Rand. Tonight's guest, Ayn Rand. Night Call is your program. Share your opinions and ideas with the rest of the country. Speak for yourself and ask your own questions directly by calling Night Call in New York City from anywhere in North America. Here are Night Call's special phone numbers. From the East and Midwest, call collect at area code 212-749-3311. From the West at 212-749-4300. And from the New York area at 866-5010. Now from New York City, Night Call's host, Del Shields.
Good evening. First, my thanks to Toby Young for being so very kind and sitting in for us for the past two evenings. Tonight, I am most privileged to have as my guest Miss Ayn Rand, the objectivist philosopher and author of numerous books, The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, The Virtue of Selfishness, among several others. Calling in from New York City is Miss Rand to discuss with us her philosophy of objectivism. And we invite you, the Night Call listener, to call in and discuss responsibly objectivism with its architect, Miss Ayn Rand. Miss Rand, good evening.
Good evening, Mr. Shields.
And thank you so very much for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here.
Miss Rand, let's begin our conversation tonight by asking you to tell us briefly what you mean by objectivism.
Objectivism is the title of my philosophical system, that is, a system of philosophy originated by me. I can only give you, naturally, a very brief summary, only in essentials. Now, in metaphysics, objectivism holds that reality, the external world, exists independent of man's consciousness, independent of any observer's knowledge, beliefs, or feelings. To exist is to be something specific, to possess identity. This means that A is A, that a thing is what it is, and that the task of man's consciousness is to perceive reality, not to create it or invent it. In regard to epistemology, objectivism holds that man's reason is fully competent to know the facts of reality. Reason is the faculty that identifies and integrates the material provided by man's senses. Reason is man's only means of acquiring knowledge, and therefore it is his basic tool of survival. In regard to ethics, objectivism holds that reason is man's only proper judge of values and his only proper guide to action. Man's rational faculty, that is, his capacity to reason, is his essential characteristic which distinguishes him from animals. The proper standard of ethics is man's life, that is, man's survival as man, as his nature requires, as a rational being, not his momentary physical survival as a mindless brute. Rationality is man's basic virtue, and his three fundamental values are reason, purpose, self-esteem. Man, every man, is an end in himself, not a means to the ends of others. He must live for his own sake, neither sacrificing himself to others, nor sacrificing others to himself. He must work for his rational self-interest with the achievement of his own happiness as the highest moral purpose of his life. This does not mean the indulgence of his irrational emotions or arbitrary whims. Rational, in this context, means based on values derived from and validated by rational principles. In regard to politics, objectivism holds that the basic social principle of the objectivist ethics is that no man has the right to seek values from others by means of physical force. That is, no man or group has the right to initiate the use of physical force against others. men have the right to use force only in self-defense and only against those who initiate its use. Men must deal with one another as traders, giving value for value by free mutual consent to mutual benefit. The only social system that bars physical force from human relationships is laissez-faire capitalism. Capitalism is a system based on the recognition of individual rights, including property rights, a system in which property is privately owned and in which the only function of the government is to protect individual rights, that is, to protect men from those who initiate the use of physical force. This is a mere summary. For a full discussion and proof, I refer you to my books, particularly to Atlas Shrugged, and to my magazine, The Objectivist.
Miss Rand, what do you mean by selfishness?
I mean the pursuit of one's proper, rational self-interest. I mean that the central purpose of one's life is to achieve one's own happiness, but, as I just stated, not sacrificing oneself nor sacrificing others to oneself. It means to live, in effect, by the judgment of one's own mind without ever forcing anything on others, and to work to live by one's own productive effort.
But do we assume in any way that a person who can live this way must be a strong person as opposed to being a weak person?
No. That is one of the fallacies of today's prevalent morality, which is altruism, the theory that holds that man must sacrifice himself to others, that only service to others is the moral justification of his life. Create or infuse men with the idea that it takes a special strength to live by the judgment of your own mind. In fact, it does not. All that it takes is honesty on whichever level of intelligence or ability you possess. The penalty for living unselfishly, that is, irrationally, the penalty for depending on others or sacrificing yourself to others is so tremendous psychologically that no man properly can or does have the strength to survive. And as proof of it, I will point out the majority of men today and the chronic misery in which they live psychologically and existentially. The cause of it is that they were weak enough to be irrational. It does not take special strength to be rational, and nor does it take special ability. It takes only honesty.
This is Night Call in New York, and tonight our conversation is The Philosophy of Ayn Rand, and Miss Rand is calling in from New York City, and Miss Rand will begin to take calls from our Night Call listeners, and we'll take our first call tonight from Cleveland, Ohio. Mr. Hall is hearing Night Call over WDWC out of Berea, Ohio. Mr. Hall? Mr. Hall?
Yes.
Good evening, sir.
Yes.
You have a question, sir?
I'd like to ask Miss Grant, first of all, could she put her philosophy into a nutshell? I mean, you know,
Well, Mr. Hall, I'm going to ask you first if you'd be kind enough to turn your radio off.
Yeah, I did.
All right, thank you.
Are you getting feedback?
Yes, we were, sir.
Hello?
Now repeat your question, sir.
First of all, I'd like her philosophy in a small portion, in a sentence.
You can't put a philosophy in a sentence, but I have just given it to you in a nutshell. That's as brief as one can put a philosophy.
Am I correct in assuming you believe in existentialism, right?
Oh, no.
No?
No.
Isn't that what you mentioned?
No. You see, the philosophy, which is very popular today and which is called existentialism, is in fact the opposite of mine. They do not believe that man can be guided by reason. They do not believe that man can be or should be rational. They believe that life is hopeless, that reality is man's enemy, and man must be guided by his emotions, in effect by his feelings, instincts, urges, drives, by his subconscious, but that his conscious mind is in fact impotent. They also believe that life is evil, that man is doomed to defeat, but he must act in spite of it, he must bravely commit himself to something, choose some value arbitrarily, and fight for it, even though he is doomed in advance. That is existentialism as a philosophical school of thought. Well, my philosophy, objectivism, is the exact opposite of it.
I see. And,
Does that answer your question, sir?
Pardon me?
Did you have another question?
Then you believe that, that men should not just believe that, that their life is completely planned out for them, but they should make an attempt at doing something, at making some type of success?
Do I believe it?
Yes.
I don't believe that life is planned for men by anyone.
Uh-huh.
Except himself.
Then man is free to live his own life, right?
He is free and should be free, and only he is qualified or has the moral right to plan his own life. But he can do it only by means of reason, by means of thinking, not by instincts or emotions.
I see. And could you, for me, define your ideas of success, what you believe success is to a man?
Success is the achievement of the rational values which a man has selected. So that if a man wants to be an artist and he achieves what he wanted to create, then he is a success, whether others agree with him or not. If a man wants to have a family and he succeeds in having a happy family, then he is a success in regard to that value. Success is really the achievement of a rational value. And by rational, I mean a value which you can justify in reason, a value which is possible in reality. If you achieve it, you are successful.
Mr. Hall, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you very much.
This time to Newark, New Jersey. Mr. Robertson is hearing Night Call over WLIB-FM in New York. Mr. Robertson?
Yes, hello, Dale.
Good evening, sir.
You?
Fine, thank you.
For one thing, hello, Miss Rand. I do agree with your philosophy to a certain extent. It does make a lot of sense. I want to ask you, what do you think is basically wrong with the philosophy that a man has gone by now?
You mean the prevalent philosophy today?
Yes, the present.
Of the present, the philosophy which most people accept.
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Yes, that's right.
The three fundamental things wrong with it. One is irrationalism or mysticism. Men have abandoned the knowledge and the respect for reason. Men do not believe any longer that reason is valid. This is the result of the kind of philosophies they have been taught for close to 200 years. Actually longer, but this is the philosophy which has been rising in dominance for the past 200 years. Irrationalism, that's one thing that's wrong. Morally, altruism, which, as I mentioned, is the moral theory which holds that the only justification of man's existence is service to others. And the third thing, politically, is collectivism. The belief that the individual has no right, that a society or a group or a nation or a collective holds all rights and may dispose of any man as it pleases. That it is its power over the individual is unlimited. These are the three fundamental evils of today's dominant philosophy. Irrationalism, altruism and collectivism.
Yes.
Mr. Robinson, thank you for calling, sir.
Yeah, wait a minute.
This is Night Call in New York. We'll return to our guest, Miss Ayn Rand, following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Ayn Rand after station identification. Call it a social pressure valve, the voice of the ghetto, the voice of disgust, the voice of hope. Call it what you will, it's the voice of the people. Night Call lets people talk, and experts on the phone anywhere in the country or in the world offer answers to some of the problems. Having a heart-to-heart squawk, at least it gets people talking, first about their problems and eventually to each other. Night Call has a potential cast of 200 million Americans, and we are now on 90 stations in 84 cities. It could just be the most important listening post on the air today because it starts people talking. A program you should listen to, a forum to speak for yourself. If we don't start talking to each other, we'll end up shouting, and there's no telling where we'll wind up after that. Night Call, every weeknight on this station. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest Ayn Rand about her philosophy and its application to today's man. Call Night Call Collect from the East End Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
Miss Rand, are you a novelist or a philosopher?
It is Mr. Shields?
Yes, ma'am, it is.
I'm both, but primarily a novelist. I'm a philosopher by necessity.
Was this the reason for the beginning of the objectivist philosophy in the various schools that you have established throughout the country?
I don't have any schools around the country, and I do not approve of any schools, and any schools organized are doing so without my sanction, or in fact against my sanction. If there are clubs of people who want to study or discuss my philosophy, and there are such, particularly on university campuses, that is their privilege, but they are organized by the students themselves and their study groups, not schools.
Well, how is the philosophy of objectivism carried out? Is this done primarily through lectures or and through your magazines?
How is any philosophy spreading or being taught? Primarily by writing. My particular philosophy is being spread by my books and by my magazine. Now, I have a magazine called The Objectivist, in which I discuss the application of my philosophy to contemporary events, to today's problems and culture. It's a monthly magazine. And I discuss this issue, also with contributors, from the viewpoint of my philosophy. That is one way of spreading ideas and of showing people how they apply to their actual lives. But outside of that, I don't endorse any school, and I want to stress it. I do not have any representatives in the country who speak for me or for objectivism. Anyone who is an objectivist will be heard from in my magazine. Outside of that, there are only students. They are not representatives of my philosophy, and they do not speak for me.
Miss Van, this time we'll go out to Lubbock, Texas. Mr. Smith is hearing Night Call over KTXT-FM. Mr. Smith?
Yes, sir.
Good evening, sir.
Oh, Mr. Shields, I'd like to thank you for your program. I think it's a very good one.
Thank you, sir.
But I'd like to ask Ms. Rand. Ms. Rand,
yes.
You say that it is wrong to sacrifice your life to another man. But can't you use another man's ideas to get a basis for your life? Or must you think of these bases on your own?
Well, no. it is not wrong to accept an idea originated or discovered by another man, provided that you have examined it yourself and that you don't accept it blindly on faith, but have found, according to your own rational judgment, that it is true, that it is right. Now, philosophy in this respect is in the same position as the physical sciences or any science. It is not wrong to accept a scientific discovery which is discovered by someone else. If you went into medicine, for instance, you do not have to discover everything from scratch. It is all right to learn from the discoverers that went on before you. But in either case, whether it's science or philosophy, you cannot claim that you know or understand or accept an idea if you merely memorize it or take it on faith. You have to subject it to the judgment of your own mind, specifically logical examination. You have to convince yourself that it is right, and then it is proper to accept it. And it is very desirable also that you originate further ideas or even a full philosophy if you find that you can, if that is your knowledge and your interest. There is no rule here in regard to knowledge about whether you should originate or learn from others. In fact, mankind is the only species that can transmit knowledge. It is quite proper to learn from others, provided, of course, you do not then claim authorship. You learn from those who went on before you, and then you continue and contribute and originate your own ideas when and as you can.
Well, I've got another question, then. Isn't it hard to dispel these ideas that you've grown up with and view them objectively?
Is it hard to correct them, you mean?
No, isn't it hard to dispel what you've grown up with, what you've been taught? Isn't it hard to look at these objectively and draw a logical conclusion if you're going to be completely honest with yourself?
No, it isn't hard.
What now?
It is not hard if you have the basic premise, the basic understanding that only reason is the ground for accepting ideas. If in childhood you have accepted a great many ideas on faith or simply in a way by conformity, these ideas may be important to you emotionally, but they do not affect your mind unless you permit your mind to be affected. Once you know that rationality consists of perceiving things correctly, that means perceiving facts, perceiving existence, once you know that, it is not difficult to correct any wrong idea or wrong premise you might have acquired. The only difficulty is that sometimes the wrong ideas create psychological problems in people. And for this, our culture certainly can be blamed, but it's also through the cooperation of the people involved. They may have psychological difficulties, but it is not impossible to correct it. In fact, there's no choice about it. If a person does not correct his ideas, he sentences himself to a life of misery, since he is acting then against reality, and he makes himself helpless.
Mr. Smith, thank you for calling, sir.
Well, sir, I was wondering one other question. Would it be okay if she told us how to get the objectivist?
With pleasure. Am I permitted to do that?
Yes, you are, Ms. Rand.
Simply by writing to the object at 201 East 34th Street, New York, 10016, and we'll send you a brochure with all the information. If I may, I'll repeat that address. 201 East 34th Street, New York, 10016.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for calling, sir. Thank you. From Lubbock, Texas to Bloomington, Indiana, Mr. Bernstein is hearing that call over WFIU-FM. Mr. Bernstein?
Yes.
Good evening, sir.
I'd like to let Miss Rand know that I am one of her students, and that I'd like to ask her if it is possible to be at the same time rational and ruthless, according to the philosophy of objectivism. If it is possible for a man to intentionally use his just property for the harm, the intentional harm of another man.
Let me get you clearly. Is it possible for a man to be rational and ruthless?
Yes.
And to use what?
To use his own property that he's acquired through his honest labor, etc.
To harm another man?
To harm another man intentionally, without any... without vengeance or without any reciprocity in mind.
Well, first of all, as a principle, if a man is rational, which means if all his ideas are based on reality, arrived at by reason and logic, and properly integrated, he would have no cause to wish to harm another man. There is no way in which anybody can or ever has found a rational justification for malice. Malice, the desire to harm another man for the purpose of harming him, in other words, to do evil for the sake of evil, is as irrational a wish or a goal as anybody could conceive of. It is completely irrational to wish to harm others.
Then a man in this position would be, in a sense, insane.
He would be very psychotic or close to it, very psychologically disturbed, if this is what you mean.
This is exactly what I mean. Is there a legal then, would it be morally justified to use legal force to commit him or to stop him in that way?
No, you don't commit people by law. That's a medical issue.
Well,
and not a moral issue. But wait, the important thing here is what you mean by harm. Harm is not that which anybody might be hurt by, because a great many people may feel that they are hurt because someone told them the truth.
Yes.
Now, they may claim that it's harm, but that it isn't what anybody rationally would define as harm. The harm that one does to other people is by infringing or violating their rights. And to violate their rights, one has to use physical force. Objectively definable, provable harm can be done by one person to another only when that person uses physical force to compel his victim to act against his own judgment, against his own will. It is only by means of physical force or fraud, which is a derivative of force, that you can objectively harm another man. That is certainly immoral, and that is what you can pass laws to prevent or to punish. It is proper to punish a man legally for violating the rights of another man, and such violation can be proved because it requires the use of physical force.
Does that answer you, Mr. Bernstein?
It does.
Thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you.
Miss Rand, am I right in assuming then that when we look at the cases of Sirhan Sirhan and James Earl Ray, who were involved in assassinations, and although there were some people who might feel that they may have applied within themselves logic and reality and perhaps some kind of rational judgment, that they do not fall into this category?
Well, those two men are so obviously irrational that by their own statements, in the case of Sirhan, for instance, it's even on record that he was a student of mysticism, of the occult, that he practices some sort of mystical tricks to control matter by means of his mind. He was an avowed mystic. Both of them are complete examples of irrationality. Now, Earl Ray was a criminal. In other words, here is a man who chooses to live by means of force, by using, robbing others. Therefore, neither of them could qualify as rational by any stretch of the imagination. Now, you must remember here that rational does not mean rationalizing. Any man can lie to himself, which is what we mean by rationalize. He can invent reasons which might appear to him logical out of context. But rational does not mean that. Rational means a policy or a principle arrived in the full context of everything relevant to a given action, particularly in regard to moral action. The first rule of rationality would necessarily hold that if you value your own life, if you believe that you are the owner of your own life, you have to recognize the same right in others. There is no way for you to prove that you have a right to your life, but another man does not. And therefore, there is no logical argument, not even out of context, by which you could attempt to prove that you have the right to take another man's life. Both those assassins, and incidentally, also Harvey Lee Oswald, have a great deal in common psychologically. Observe that all three of them apparently wanted to kill in order to attract attention to themselves. That is a confession of an abysmal lack of self-esteem. The desire to be noticed, the desire to gain attention regardless of the nature of your own action, the desire to be famous as a monster just so people will pay attention to you. That the psychology of these three men is as evil as anything we have had displayed in public for a long time.
Miss Rand will return with more telephone calls following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Ayn Rand after station identification. Next week on Night Call, Del Shields with his guests, the director of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Mentally Retarded, Dr. Donald Stedman, the junior congressman from Harlem, Adam Clayton Powell, Swedish sociologist Gunnar Myrdal, and the head of the new movement to support George Wallace for president, Dr. Beverly McDowell. Monday, Mental Retardation with Dr. Donald Stedman. Tuesday, The New Congress, What Can We Expect? With the junior congressman from Harlem, Adam Clayton Powell. Wednesday, Del Shields talks with you, the listener, about what's happened since the Kerner Report. Thursday, the Swedish sociologist Gunnar Myrdal discusses the United States, how other nations see us. And Friday, whatever happened to George Wallace, with the new head of the Wallace for President movement, Dr. Beverly McDowell. All this next week on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself, collect from anywhere in North America to guest Ayn Rand about her philosophy and its application to today's man. Call Night Call Collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
And during this next half hour, we'll begin by going up to Buffalo, New York. Mr. Childs is hearing Night Call over WBFO-FM. Mr. Childs?
Yes, Mr.
Good evening, sir.
Mr. Rand, I have two questions. First, concerning student takeovers of state universities, insofar as the government is a thief stealing everything that it has, what property rights can it consistently claim to have?
I didn't hear the middle part of your question.
I said that insofar as the government is a thief,
yes,
stealing everything that it has through taxation, what property rights can it consistently claim to have?
The government as such, properly, in a fully free society, does not have property rights. except in a very limited sense, such as owning the necessary buildings or equipment for its proper functions, which consists only of the judicial system, the police, and the armed forces. Outside of that, the government does not and properly cannot claim any property rights. Now, the issue of whether the government or a state should own a university, I would answer, of course not. A government cannot, should not own a university. But inasmuch as we have a mixed economy, that is a system which is part free enterprise, part capitalism, that is, and part collectivism or statism, we have a great many institutions which are based on mixed premises and which do not work very well. Now, a state university, according to this principle, is owned by the taxpayers of the state. It is a form of collective ownership. It's not very practical. Nevertheless, it is the taxpayers who own a state university. It certainly is not the students or the faculty. And the rights of the taxpayers have to be respected. If a state university is managed by a board of trustees who were appointed by elected officials, then they have to act as the agents of the owners and respect and protect property rights. Even if, let us say, there were such things as ownerless property. Let us suppose somebody died and didn't leave any heirs, and therefore for the moment one does not know to whom that property belongs. This is not an excuse for the first passerby to seize it. And there is no excuse for the students and faculty members who today seize everybody else's property, both state universities and private universities. The issue of state property is not involved here and is not a justification for the actions of today's college rebels.
Mr. Charles, why do you say the government is a thief?
Because it's based on taxation, which means it's based on the power to coercively collect or confiscate a part of a man's income. In other words, it takes a person's property without his consent, which is my definition of thievery or robbery. Therefore, I conclude that the government is a thief, since it does not get its income through voluntary contributions. In effect, it says to a man, your money or your life, and it will threaten to put you in prison if you do not pay its tributes. I think in this respect, it's very similar to the mafia.
Hello?
How do you feel about that, Miss Rand?
I would like to comment on that. There is a certain sense in which the speaker is right, but in a particular sense, namely, the question of, is it proper for the government to have the power to tax? And I would agree with you, no, the government should not have the power to tax. All taxation should be voluntary. And as to the practical question of how to do it, or practical suggestions, you will find them in my book, Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal, in an article specifically devoted to this subject, the subject of voluntary taxation or voluntary support of the government. However, again, in the present context, you cannot say that the government is a thief in the same sense in which you would call a private thief that. The government is not a thief. Too often, in a mixed economy, it acts like a looter. It doesn't steal. It seizes property. And it is true that it is not entitled to it, that the principle of taxation is an improper one. But then it is an issue to be settled by constitutional means. It does not give leeway to private individuals to then arbitrarily rob others, including the government.
Does it give the right to an individual to refuse to pay the tax?
The right, moral right, yes. Unfortunately, this political right is not recognized, and he would pay too heavy a penalty for not paying it. But morally, yes, he would have the right to refuse.
Mr. Childs, thank you for calling, sir. Thank you. This time out to San Jose, California, Mr. Burns is hearing night call over, I hope, KCJC. Mr. Burns?
Hello.
The station you're calling from, sir?
KFJC.
I beg your pardon?
KFJC.
Oh, KFJC. Thank you, sir. Your question?
Well, about 5 years ago, I read a monologue in one of Miss Rand's books. And the idea of it stayed with me, and I've been looking for the book ever since. And I was wondering if she could identify it for me.
You mean you've read it, but you forgot the name of the book?
Yeah.
Well, all right.
The general tone of it was that this individual refused to bargain his rights as an individual and his freedom for a handout, and that he refused to be ashamed of his ability to produce.
Oh. It isn't the exact summary, but you've read Atlas Shrugged. That is the book in which many monologues and dialogues are included on this subject of a man's right to produce and his refusal to be ashamed of his own ability.
It was just a short thing, but it stuck with me, and I've been looking for the book ever since.
Short thing?
Well, short in comparison to the rest of them in the book.
You meant that the particular phrase that the phrase that you're making reference to?
This entire monologue, as I recall, it was only about a page and a half long.
It's probably written statement in Atlas Shrugged. But anyway, on this subject, I'm quite sure that it was Atlas Shrugged, which is a very long book.
Oh, yeah, I know the book. I know the book is long.
Well, that is where...
If I can find it...
Several statements.
What I'd like to do is reprint it with your permission in the Foothill College newspaper, school paper.
Pardon?
If I can find it in the book, what I'd like to do is reprint it in our school, our college paper.
For that you have to write to me. Write to me in care of the Objectivist and state the context in which you want to reprint it. What would be surrounding it, in effect, what other statements of yours or your editors would be involved. And according to that, I will be able to judge whether I can give you permission or not. But I appreciate your interest.
All right. Do you have any idea where in the book that appears?
Well, it's a little hard for me to identify from your description.
Yeah, I imagine so.
Thank you for calling, sir. Thank you. Miss Rand, speaking of Atlas Shrugged, why did you write this book?
Because I like the story. To begin with, I always write primarily because I want to create, to project the image of an ideal man and to present him in action. That is the goal of everything I have ever written. When I write a novel, I do not write it primarily to spread certain ideas. When I want to do that, I write nonfiction. But in a novel, the primary purpose are the characters and the story. But now, why did I include philosophical ideas? Because in order to present an ideal man, or in fact any man, one needs a certain philosophical background, implicit or explicit. In order to make any statement about human life, one has to have a philosophical frame of reference, a philosophical base. And I found that my idea of the ideal man, my ideas on ethics of what was right, contradicted the majority of everything written in philosophy. There was no philosophical base which would correspond to my ideas. Therefore, I had to define my own philosophy, my own fundamental ideas of what is right for man and what would constitute an ideal man. Therefore, it is from that purpose that I went into philosophy, because I found it on the basis of existing philosophies, which are full of mystical contradictions, was the only philosopher whom I accept from it, and to whom I acknowledge a philosophical debt, which is Aristotle, in this kind of situation, my type of fiction would be impossible. I had to define my own philosophy in order to make my characters and my stories clear. But my primary purpose are my characters and my story.
Mr. Rand, we'll return with more calls following station identification. Stay tuned for the Night Call Network.
More Night Call with Del Shields and guest Ayn Rand after station identification. Tomorrow night on Night Call, more than a man can take. The problems of mental depression with Del Shields and his guest, Reverend Wesley Baker. Mental depression is not a pretense. It may be a matter of the mind, but it is not an imaginary illness. It is not ordinary sadness or sorrow. Depression is defenseless, hopeless, horrible. Depression means losing all meaning in life, breaking all human contacts. It is despair. It is almost death. It is hell. Depression removes its victim from the world, from those he loves, from God, and from himself. And at the same time, it forces him to go on living as though he were really alive. Depression is a living death. The causes are complex, the solutions are not easy. Reverend Wesley Baker speaks from a background of religious experience and training. But perhaps of more value, he speaks from immediate personal affliction. More Than a Man Can Take with Del Shields and his guest, Reverend Wesley Baker, tomorrow night on Night Call. Ask your own questions direct. Speak for yourself collect from anywhere in North America to guest Ayn Rand about her philosophy and its application to today's man. Call Night Call collect from the East and Midwest on area code 212-749-3311. From the West on area code 212-749-4300. And from the New York area on 866-5010. Again, Del Shields.
Our next night caller is Mr. Longenecker, who is hearing Night Call over WHP in Harrisburg. He's calling in from Anvil, Pennsylvania. Mr. Longenecker?
Hello.
How are you, sir?
Fine, thank you. I enjoy your program very much.
Thank you very much, sir.
I have a question.
Your question, sir.
Yes. I would like to ask Miss Rand, do you include in your philosophy any dimension of existence outside this human mortal life? Is there room in your system of thought for a theistic being?
No, there is not. I include in my system of philosophy only that which man can grasp, perceive, identify, and demonstrate by means of reason. We have no evidence of any kind of any so-called afterlife or of another mystical dimension, and my philosophy does not permit the invention of facts or the acceptance of anything on faith that is without factual, rational demonstration.
And you feel that you can account for the universe and for human existence without this dimension?
I don't quite know what you mean by accounting for the universe. If you mean explain what the universe consists of, that is a job for science, not philosophy.
Yes, I agree.
Science studies. But if you mean now philosophically, the universe does not need explanation. The universe, remember what the word means. It means everything which exists.
Yes.
You do not explain everything that exists. Existence does not require explanation. Because observe the following contradiction. Where do you stand intellectually if you are going to explain existence? Where are you, the observer? You are part of existence. Existence exists, and only existence exists. Existence, as such, does not require explanation. It requires study. We need to know what exists, what is its nature, what are the laws of nature. But the attempt to explain those source of existence or of the universe is a contradiction in terms. The same, of course, applies to human life.
I find too much compulsion to awe. I stand in amazement of life and the wonders of the universe. And I think the space program and our scientific exploits are enlarging this all the time. And I just can't account for this on the basis of accident or lack of design. It's too much for me, frankly.
I would suggest that you identify very clearly the meaning of every concept that you use. There is no design in nature. If you mean the consistency of nature, the fact that nature follows certain laws, this is not design. This is the function of the law of identity, by which we mean the fact that things are what they are. And since contradictions cannot exist, since a thing, an existent, cannot be itself and not itself at the same time, certainly you will have then what is improperly called an orderly, non-contradictory universe. But the sole explanation necessary for it is the grasp that contradictions cannot exist and there is no such thing as chance in the universe. In material nature, nothing happens by chance, nor by design. These are not the alternatives. Things happen according to the law of identity. Things act and interact according to their natures. It is certainly not chance. Chance is a concept pertaining only to human ignorance. When we do not know the causes of certain events, we say it happened by chance. But nothing happens by chance except human irrationality. That is, man, and even that is not by chance. Man has free will. Therefore, he may do things without reasons or by subconscious reasons, by accidental associations, and he will describe it as acting by chance. But if you're speaking philosophically and metaphysically, that is, if you're speaking of the nature of reality, nothing happens by chance.
Mr. Longenecker, thank you for calling,
sir.
Thank you. This time out to Bellevue, Nebraska, Mr. Douthat, I think it is calling in from KBON. Mr. Douthat?
Yes, I'm here.
Your question, sir.
I have a question for Ms. Rand on the question of romantic love between man and woman. Dagny Taggart in Atlas Shrugged seems to jump from one man to another, and they both seem to be good men, Reardon and Galt. And I don't understand how there's any stability in Miss Rand's concept of romantic love. If you love for a profit, that is, someone you value, you always find someone you value more, won't you? Therefore, is there any stability in her concept of love?
No, you didn't quite understand it correctly. If you find somebody you value, and then you find somebody you value more, it doesn't mean that you fall out of love with the first person and necessarily fall in love with the second one. Although love is a response to values, to the values one finds in another person. But it doesn't mean that once you are in love, you will necessarily change if you meet somebody better. However, in Atlas Shrugged, in Dagny's case, observe that she had three men in her life, and that by today's standard, you would call her a very repressed woman. That's not what I would call it. But that three men in a woman's life does not mean she's jumping from one man to another, as I believe you called it.
Well, she progressed upward.
Pardon me, I'm not through. Now, observe that in both her first romances, in the case of Francisco D'Anconia, then in the case of Hank Reardon, she was not committed to that man for life as her one and only love. In the case of Francisco, because they were both too young. In the case of Reardon, because he had psychological problems, or really philosophical problems to be exact. He was married. It was a relationship which was not begun on the understanding that it is the final choice of their life. And because she was not fully committed, when she met John Galt, she was free to realize that he was exactly the type of man that she had always hoped to find. She was emotionally and intellectually free to fall in love. Now, if her relationship with, let us say, Hank Reardon had been different, and they were both committed to a full romance, if they were married or living together permanently, then she would have still responded to Galt in regard to finding him attractive or appreciating his value. But that appreciation would not have developed into real love. Then she would not have left Reardon.
Mr. Douthat, thank you for calling, sir.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. This time out to Kirkland, Washington, Mr. Keeney is hearing Night Call over KUOW-FM. Mr. Keeney?
Yes.
Good evening, sir.
Mr. Rand, my question is that if two persons are as objective and completely rational as they can be, then you your philosophy would contend that they would share the identical realities. Is that true?
What do you mean by identical reality?
Well, their two realities would be the same, totally the same.
Well, wait a moment. I don't believe that you are using the word reality in the way it is properly used, or in the way I used. Reality means that which exists. Now, there is no such thing as two realities, one for each person. Reality is one and the same for all of us. Do you mean their view of reality would be identical?
Well, the reality as we perceive it. I guess that's my problem. I wonder if we're humanly capable of actually comprehending a total reality.
Well, you see, that is the most profound philosophical problem, and that is why I started my presentation by mentioning metaphysics and epistemology. Epistemology is the branch of philosophy which deals with the question of man's ability to acquire knowledge. Another word for epistemology is the theory of knowledge. And the foundation of my philosophies and Aristotle's is precisely this issue, that there is only one reality and that man is competent to grasp it. This doesn't mean that man has to be omniscient or infallible, but it means that he has the capacity to understand, to know that which is real, and to expand his knowledge.
Miss Rand, I'm sorry, but time has run out on us. Mr. Keeney, thank you so very much for calling. Miss Rand, thank you so very much for being our guest tonight on Night Call.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
This is Del Shields in New York. Good night and peace.
Tomorrow night, same time, same station, More Than a Man Can Take with Reverend Wesley Baker. Listen tomorrow night, discuss freely and responsibly your own personal opinions. Speak for yourself on Night Call. Produced by the United Methodist Church, presented with National Council of Churches, National Catholic Office for Radio and Television, American Jewish Committee, and Urban Coalition.